In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss dealing with crunch time stress, balancing life and work, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 201. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
Well, I'm getting kind of back on track after taking the weekend off and going on my personal retreat because I'd spent the weekend at my cottage up in the Adirondacks, but the weather was kind of crappy. So I came home a day early and then kind of spent the rest of my retreat in the basement.
What came out of that? Did you find it enlightening? Because this is kind of the first one that you've done. So I imagine it was probably takes a little while to get into it and wondering if anything came out of it.
It actually didn't take me very long to get into it at all. I mean, I started on Friday night. I started making notes and stuff right away. I kind of separated it out into three different things. Like I had a Google Doc that I was kind of working from to at least start off with. And I had a list of questions to ask myself. And then I had like a bunch of, you know, tips during the retreat for myself. And then I was like, okay, and I need to have something that kind of comes out of this. So beyond my notes and stuff, I want to have some sort of an action list. And what I found was that, first of all, like notebooks do not work for me. My writing skills just do not keep up with what I'm thinking about. So I kind of ditched it and went to the iPad and was just banging out notes left and right. And that really helped move things along. The other thing that came out of it was like my action list actually spawned off other action lists. So I've got different action lists for different projects and different goals and things like that.
Nice. And so you have like a personal side and a business side to it?
I have some action lists for like personal stuff and then some that are directly related to like specific aspects of the business. So for example, like Audit Shark Marketing just had one action list onto itself. And then there were other things that, you know, kind of ancillary.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. The reason notebooks work for me is that I don't take word for word notes. I do a lot more thinking than I do writing. So I will spend 30 minutes not writing anything and just in deep, deep thought and trying to mull through a topic and maybe sketching or drawing to try to get the more creative side of my brain going as I'm thinking through this, maybe doing a little bit of research here and there, but then I'll come to kind of an epiphany and then I'll jot that down or I'll come to a conclusion. It's rare that I'm actually thinking out loud like it's a journal or something because you're right. If I was doing that, I would want to type because you think faster than you can write these days.
Yeah, what I found was I would just write out brief thoughts and then kind of go back and take a look at them and reread them. And that was really where my epiphany started to come from. Like I would write down a bunch of my thoughts and then go back and reread them. And then that's when I would have those insights that I really kind of needed to have.
Very cool. So was it worth it or do you plan to do another one?
Oh, definitely. But I'm definitely going to start to kind of regularly schedule them.
Yeah, I think annual is the minimum for me, and I think every 6 months is more ideal.
I did find one thing, though. Camping is not the ideal situation for going on a personal retreat because having to stop and like do the dishes mm-hmm. and cook and things like that,
sure.
It just totally blows apart, you know, some of your schedules.
Yeah, so. How interesting. Yeah, so I've never done that because it kills your flow.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that before I went,
but
in retrospect, certain times of the day, I just wasn't productive at all. And then there were other times like early evening after I'd eaten dinner, I was very productive.
Right. So I had a bit of a rocky start to my Labor Day weekend on Friday. I really need to give special thanks to my DBA. His name's Creston Jameson, and he runs Ruby Tree Software. And he basically was doing a restore to test, just to test database backups. And our previous DBA had stopped testing the restores a few months ago. And so Friday night, he emails me and he says, we have a problem. The restore is not working. Like it's not working as we would expect. So he basically spent that night just an hour or two, but he really came up in the clutch for me and got everything working again. But I don't know how far back that, you know, how long can that go on before you have an issue and then you go to restore and it's not there. So yeah, I highly recommend this guy. It's rubytreesoftware.com. His name's Creston and he's a Rails developer. He does performance tuning and he's also a Postgres DBA. So just wanted to give him a shout out and a thanks for working on a Friday night of a 3-day weekend for us.
Yeah, that's kind of scary to, you know, have stuff like that running in the background. And if you don't test it, how would you know that it's not working?
I know.
basically your entire business is kind of hinging on that stuff working if there's ever a problem.
Seriously. These background processes, and you get so many of them as your app grows. I find it really hard to just keep tabs on all of them, even with tools like New Relic and Monit, and there's all this other stuff that can look at it, but really getting down to the nuts and bolts, at a certain point, you just have to have someone on a recurring basis actually getting in there and doing some things just to verify that everything is in fact functioning. Well, we have a bunch of listener questions. There are several that have been emailed to us, and then we have several from Twitter that I just asked for questions. We got some pretty good ones. So let's kick us off with the first one. It's about whether to build a fresh solution for an existing market, and it's from Bill Eisenhower. And he says, "Hi, I've run across a couple of niche markets recently where there are SaaS apps that look fairly crufty by today's standards. It seems like a reasonable assumption to conclude that there's money in those spaces. My question is, what do you think about entering into those types of markets? You have the advantage of being able to offer a potentially fresher solution, but you definitely begin life fighting well-established others for market share. Any advice or thoughts?"
I think that the fact that there's other SaaS apps in that area is partly a good sign, because it means that there are people that are willing to pay for that. So that essentially takes away one of the things that you need to worry about when you're building a new application. The thing you do have to wonder about is, where are they currently getting their traffic from, and where are they getting their customers from? Kind of, what are their price points? Do they have sales reps who are talking to people? How far behind are you? Is there a way that you can take whatever the solution is that they're offering and basically break it apart and only solve a very small piece of the problem that's big enough that people are actually willing to pay for? So those are the things that I would probably keep in mind, but you definitely want to test to figure out what are the types of sales channels that are going to work for you, because I think that's the bigger piece of the problem that you need to be able to resolve before you start writing code and figuring out a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I have some doubts about that a market is proven just because there's a SaaS app in the space. I think you want to go one step further and try to figure out how much revenue they have. Try to do some search, whether it's compete.com, to figure out how much traffic, do online research, look at Crunchbase, whatever you can to try to figure out how big they are, because there are a lot of SaaS apps in a lot of spaces, and they may or may not have ever really hit critical mass. And so just because an app's built, if it looks crufty, maybe they only got to 5,000 in recurring revenue, and that's how big the market is. So I think that's the first thing I'd be careful of, is assuming that there is a market just because they're there. Second thing, my initial inclination, if there's a crufty SaaS app, would be to buy it rather than to try to build one. And here's why. If they are doing well, then they already have enough traffic, they have Google authority, they have in-house knowledge, they've probably learned a ton about this market and the marketing. There's just a lot of stuff there. So even if you have to wind up rewriting a lot of the app or doing a lot of improvements to it, like I did with Hittail a few years ago, you are going to be so far ahead if you were to acquire their traffic and acquire their existing customer base and acquire all of that, as much of that knowledge as you can garner, rather than trying to build it from scratch. It's literally, you know, it's a 1 to 2 year jump. Yeah, obviously, it depends on if you can afford it and, you know, if that's something you want to do. But that would be my initial inclination going into an existing market.
The other thing is that by starting that discussion about acquiring them, you could probably get some more information about them.
Yeah, and that's interesting. But it's like, if you genuinely are interested in acquiring them, then it's not like you're doing it in bad faith, right? You actually are interested in trying to figure out if it's something you guys could work out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that depends a lot on whether or not you have the money and, you know, how good your estimation skills are in terms of how big they are. Because if you look at them and you're not real sure and you make an offer of, I don't know, say $10,000 or $15,000 or something like that, and they say, yeah, we make that in a week, then, well, you know, they just told you that they make $10,000 to $15,000 a week. So
right.
It may give you an idea of what the market's like.
So thanks for the question, Bill. Hope that was helpful. Our next question comes from JJ, and he says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. I'd love to hear about dealing with crunch time stress, the stress of short, intense required work, like an initial rollout, major upgrades, and transitions. Some things that come to mind are making lists, decreasing caffeine, dry runs, and test environments. By now, I've listened to every show of your podcast. Although I'm in a small enterprise environment, I found your podcast useful to promote my work within the organization. Thanks."
Well, I think if anything, decreasing your caffeine levels is probably a bad thing during that crunch lunchtime.
Right.
That's my first thought. But I think that as you get closer to those types of things, you start to realize that there are some things that you're looking at or you're trying to do that are simply not nearly as important or not as critical to whatever that time deadline is. So, you know, as you get closer to a rollout, you may decide that there's a lot of work that you can just push off, whether it's features or certain types of testing or certain designs and things like that. There are always things that you can kind of cut and push off to the future. So from a work management standpoint, you always have that option available to you. The second thing is that unless you have kind of publicly made those deadlines available to everybody and told people, hey, this is coming out on Saturday, who's to say that that work effort has to be done by that time? You can push it out if you need to. It's not to say that you want to, but if you need to in order to de-stress a little bit, certainly that you should use that as an option, because the last thing you want to do is get into a situation where you're working really hard initial rollout and you're doing all these major upgrades and code restructuring and things like that, and then you kind of launch it to people and you may mistakenly think, oh, okay, now the hard work's over, now I get to go out and do marketing stuff or work with customers. And the reality is that's where the work begins. So telling yourself that it's the other way around, that you're going to be able to take a break, is not the ideal scenario. You want to be able to manage that long term.
Yeah, I'd agree with Mike. I think it's interesting that JJ brought up caffeine, like decreasing caffeine, because if you're naturally an anxious person, then obviously caffeine can increase anxiety. But I find that it also makes you tend to perform. You're more focused and you're able to get things done. So I tend to increase my caffeine during these crunch times. Now, if your crunch time is 3 months long, then obviously that's not a good thing and you need to figure out what you're doing wrong so that your crunch time is that long. But when you have a few days, you know, we pulled an all-nighter about a month and a half ago, and actually I went to bed fairly early. It was one developer stayed up most of the night rolling out Hittail from ASP and moving into the Rails version, doing a database migration. And frankly, we had this by the minute account of what it was going to be. And I learned to do this from when I was an electrician and we would do shutdowns of data centers. You had to have this shutdown list, a shutdown checklist. And you had to have this thing mapped out by the minute to make sure you didn't anything messed up. And then you had multiple supervisors essentially approve this and walk through it and offer feedback and all that stuff. Sounds like a bunch of stuff by committee, you know, which I hate. But when you're doing something that's this time critical, it is so much better to literally, we had it in a Google Doc. It ran by the letter and we could tell when we were ahead or behind, and we could tell if this thing was going to take until 7 a.m. or if it was going to take until 4 a.m, because we could tell if we were, you know, ahead or behind in the schedule. So I think lists is not necessarily it, but it's kind of like having a well-documented process for something that's super intense. And then having, I guess we had also had a testing checklist of everything that I wanted to test once we rolled out. And it just gave me the confidence that I wasn't thinking about this at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. when your head isn't clear. I had thought about it 2 weeks prior, and then I'd had a few people read it. We revised it. We worked on it together. And the thing was pretty rock solid by the time it was done. It's like the advanced preparation is what will help you with that major upgrade or transition.
Yeah, as you point out, the last thing you want to be doing is making major decisions at 3 a.m.
So thanks for your question, JJ. I hope that helps. Our next email is actually not a question, but it's a comment with some really good insights. And it's about episode 186 we did. It was on life hacks for entrepreneurs. And this email is from Michał Damanski. He's a longtime listener. He said he wanted to share some of his own simple life hacks. And I won't be able to share them all, but we'll add them into the show notes for this episode. Here's several things that he suggested that he's been using to hack his life, essentially. One is to buy food online. Saves time and money. Is don't buy sugared soda. Try finding something sweetened with xylitol or stevia. If not possible, go for zero calorie options, because this saves between 400 and 800 calories a day if you drink a lot of soda.
Real quick, to go back to that last one, buying food online, mm-hmm. saving time and money. It definitely saves time, but most people say it will probably cost you more money because then you have to have it delivered and everything else.
Another couple he has is to try short, high-intensity workouts like Tabata method or prison workout, and he gives us a link there. And the last one that I like is to have a bottle of mineral water nearby. Developers consume a lot of caffeine, and that flushes minerals and dehydrates you. So replenishing yourself with water doesn't replace those minerals.
So what's next on the list?
Well, next, we haven't done this before, but I went to Twitter this afternoon and just asked what if people had any questions for us to discuss on the podcast. And the first question actually came back from Alan Branch of Less Everything. And he said, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on balancing life and work and what a typical day schedule looks like.
I think that for me, balancing life and work has a lot to do with bouncing back and forth between them. So depending on the day of the week and depending on what's going on that day, I might do a lot more work stuff or I might do a lot more life stuff. So on Tuesdays, for example, are a complete mess just because of the way the schedule works out. My wife teaches Zumba classes. And so I'm constantly bouncing back and forth on Tuesdays. Wednesdays are a lot more open. Mondays are a lot more open. But Tuesdays are just kind of a nightmare. In terms of having to bounce back and forth. And then just being able to make sure that you set aside specific times where you're going to stop working. I try not to work on the weekends. I do on occasion. It usually depends on, like, if I have a Monday that gets blown apart because of a holiday or something comes up and I have to get off schedule, then I might reserve like a Saturday or Sunday. It's just a matter of rearranging and knowing what my schedule is and my wife's schedule. Like, we actually have our calendar shared so that I can pull up my calendar and I'll look at it and I'll see when she's busy, see when I'm busy and see what the overlaps are and see where one of us is going to have to deal with the kids or attend something that we may not have planned on. So like my kids are in karate, they're both in soccer, you know, and those things got to be taken into account.
Yeah, in terms of balancing life and work for me, it's the same way. I was at my son's school today for 30 minutes helping out because he had an issue going on. And so I walked over from work. And so I find that the two kind of overlap a lot more than I thought they would. And frankly, a lot more than I'd hoped they would because I don't do well with interruptions. And I'm interrupted at least once or twice a day with something, with the school calling or with my wife saying, hey, I need you to pick this up because this person didn't show up. Or, you know, we just have a lot of moving parts with two full-time working parents. But with that said, I feel like balancing life and work involves a couple things. One, when I'm working, I try to be really, really focused and work. So I don't sit around the water cooler and talk to people and waste time, or at least I try not to. And so I put on music, I drink some caffeine, and I get very intense about what I'm doing. And I just roll with it and try to be highly productive. Then when I'm done, I try to, as much as I can, to shut that off and to completely walk away from email and walk away from social media and not be trying to work while I'm with my kids. I'll do stuff like leave my phone, you know, in a certain place in the house and just not check it for several hours, which means that I can focus on playing games with my kids and hanging out and helping them practice instruments. And so I find that I want to do one thing really well at a time and not try to, I almost never try to work when my kids are at home because I find that it means I'm not doing a good job at work and I'm getting irritated and it feels to the kids like you're paying more attention to something else. You know, the one other thing is that I try to take some time for myself every day. And often now that I have like a 15-minute drive each way to the office, that's a perfect time. I listen to podcasts. I also do that when I'm doing the dishes in the evening or if I'm cooking. That's really my time. So when I'm doing that, I actually will tell people like, can you go into the other room and do something? Because me sitting there in my own head with the podcast playing, that is where I'm able to have some time to myself because we all need that, right? You can't just be at work, then be with other people all the time. It's really hard. We, especially as introverts, a lot of us, we'll get exhausted with that. And so that's where I feel like I'm balancing both work and my family and my own life, trying to balance those three things. And then in terms of typical day schedule, I don't know that there is a typical day. I guess if I'm not traveling, yeah, I typically work about 9 to 4, and then I do a few hours in the evening if needed.
It's interesting you brought up the listening to podcasts and stuff while you're doing the dishes. I listen to podcasts while I'm at the gym working out because it's a perfect time to do both and I don't really have to concentrate on lifting weights or anything.
Next question is basically a follow-up. Ruben Gomez from BidSketch chimed in and he said, when do you decide to temporarily change your normal schedule to work more or less and the trade-offs that come with that? This is a really good question, actually. I've done this a lot in terms of ramping. I'll ramp up my schedule and I will make a concerted effort and I'm intentional about it and I will talk to my wife and those around me and say, I'm going to be working nights and I'm going to try to put in a couple 50 or 60 hour weeks because we're ramping up and we need to deploy something or this is just a really big push time for us. And then other times I will back completely off. When we had our second child a few years ago, I worked about 12 to 16 hours a week for 10 months. And at other times, you know, I'm going to Thailand for a month here in a couple weeks and I'm going to back way off, obviously, right? Because of the travel and I want to be able to do things with the family and hang out. So I think another point that is less, maybe people would expect less, is at a certain point with development of Drip, so much needed to get done and I couldn't help with it. I backed my hours off on Drip because there was no more marketing and no more sales was gonna help it because churn was too high and we weren't at product market fit. And so I actually backed my hours off and put him towards other things, basically towards MicroConf and Hittail, and I even took some time to myself and just took some time off work. So that's when I've decided to do it. Those have been kind of the instances where I will ramp up or ramp down. You know, Ruben asked about the trade-offs. I don't know that I've ever really had a big negative impact from any of those things.
The thing that comes to mind is for me is that you intentionally do that, and I do as well. And I think that that's kind of the key to the being able to change your schedule to work more or less, is that when you do it, it needs to be intentional. Like if you're gradually ramping up and you keep going up and up and you don't necessarily realize it, you can find yourself in a bad situation because you're not doing it intentionally. And things are probably going wrong at that point, especially if you're ramping up. If you're ramping down, maybe you're just getting burnt out. But I think that either ramping up or down, it has to be done intentionally. You have to think about what it is that you're doing and why you're doing it and what those trade-offs are. And when you do that, consciously making that decision to perform those trade-offs, and at that point, because you've made the decision, it's not a big deal. At that point, those trade-offs, you've kind of already mentally made those decisions.
Yeah, I like that. I don't know that I had put it in those terms, but the intentionality is a big piece of it. When I was a salaried employee, I remember when other people would make the choice for me, meaning they would force me to work more, really, really got to me. And then, you know, as soon as I was able to control that, it doesn't bother me nearly as much, especially when I know that it's a short season, right? If I'm going to work more, it's going to be for a few weeks here and there. And I need to keep myself accountable to that and not try to work 60-hour weeks for 4 months. Because it's just not a sustainable lifestyle. Cool. Our next question is from Toby Osborne, also from Twitter. He says, what do you both do to completely relax away from startups, things like video games, sports, etc.?
For me, it's a combination of three different things. One is I'll play video games. A second thing is, you know, I'll read books. And then the third one is watching movies. So those are kind of the three things that I like to do that's outside of startups. Even like the books and stuff that I read, they're all fiction. They have nothing to do with business or anything like that. It's just, I basically just kind of put my brain in another world. And then the same thing with movies.
Nice. Yeah, I really enjoy good television. We'll watch Game of Thrones and was watching Breaking Bad, Walking Dead, Mad Men. You know, really solid, episodic, long-running television that's well done. I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I enjoy that. So that's not completely away from startups, but I do listen to a lot of stuff on the Twit Network, which is just a tech network, and then all the podcasts from Tom Merritt, which are some of them about, you know, cord killing, and there's Daily Tech News and that kind of stuff. That's not really about startups. It doesn't help me in work, but it is entertaining, and it allows me to be kind of in my own head for a while each day. I find that really relaxing. I also play music. I've been playing the guitar since I was in college. I haven't written a song in a while. I was in a couple bands, but I find it being very relaxing to sit back and play old tunes that I'm familiar with, whether they're things that I wrote or music from other people. And then I think lastly, frankly, being with my family, we go to the coast of California quite often, a couple times a month at least. And that time there, it allows me to completely relax. As long as I don't fill it with thinking about work, brainstorming about work, getting emails about work and all that kind of stuff, I find that I can really unwind there. You know, I think the one other thing is I've been backing a lot of games on Kickstarter, like board games and card games, and there's been a resurgence in my desire to play those. So I've been playing them with my son's now 8, and we play games all the time. And they're either pretty simple role-playing games or, you know, adventure games with cards and strategy games. And we got Lord of the Rings Risk and all that kind of stuff. That's been really fascinating to me lately. Oh, we played chess a lot this weekend, too. I remember playing it as a kid, and then at a certain point, you get, quote-unquote, too busy to do this kind of stuff. I guess having a kid, for me, is like an excuse to be able to do that, right? Because I would never carve out time. I would just work more. But it allows me to be forced into carving out that time to have some fun and relax.
Yeah, my kids are always bugging me to play a card game called Boss Monster, which was available at ThinkGeek for a while. I don't know if it's available anywhere else right now. That's kind of a fun game. They like that.
Very cool. Our last question of the day comes from Craig VN, and it was from the Bootstrapped.fm forums. He says, our SaaS pricing is basically done on a user level basis, 2, 8, or unlimited users. I'm considering changing this to 1, 5, 10, and unlimited, but for now, that is what we have. It is not uncommon for clients who have three users to ask for a discount or be able to go on the lower level plan. What is your strategy for dealing with this? Do you just give them the discount out of goodwill? One thing I am considering is if I give them the discount, asking for a testimonial in exchange.
I kind of like the idea of asking them for a testimonial in exchange. The problem, I think, with that is that they're asking for a discount and they probably haven't used the product yet, or maybe they're still in the free trial. I mean, I guess if they're using a free trial, then that's a great time to get a testimonial from them because they're still kind of in the honeymoon phase. But I think it depends on why it is that they're asking for the discount. I'd look, take a look at the pricing itself and say, is there a massive difference between the 2-user and the 8-user plan? Yeah, if there's a big pricing difference, then and they're only a 3-person company, then it could be a problem. Or if they're like bootstrapped, if they still don't have anybody working full time, that could be an issue. So I think you really need to understand why it is that they're asking for this discount and try and cater to them a little bit. Another option that you would have is that you can say, okay, 2 users, 8 users, and then unlimited. But if you want to go from 2 users to 3 users, it costs an extra $10 a month or something like that. So you could kind of ramp it up a little bit and say you're kind of allowing them to do it a la carte, but you're not basically pushing them all the way to that next pricing plan. But I wouldn't offer that to everybody. I would really just do it as kind of a one-off thing when people ask, because you don't really want to make your pricing pages too complicated or make people make too many decisions. But the people who are coming to you and asking them for that kind of thing, they're essentially going out of their way. So those are the types of things I would think about, just because I don't know how frequently these requests come in and what the pricing difference is between the different levels and things like that. But those are the types of things I would think about. The other thing I would think about is whether or not you're devaluing the higher tier plan by giving them more users. Maybe you take your users and shift them around a little bit. So you said that you've been thinking about changing from 1 to 5 to 10 and unlimited. But maybe you offer your software on a flat per user plan. Something along those lines might work. There's some SaaS applications that make it work well, and there's some that it just doesn't work as well for, because tier pricing sounds great on the surface, and it does generally, I would say, the evidence points to it being better. But I would say that it's also a case by case on each SaaS product, because just because that's a general rule that tiered pricing works better doesn't mean that it applies across the board and that it's going to work better in every situation.
First thing I'll say is I wouldn't give them a discount and ask for a testimonial in exchange. That feels weird to me. I've never done that. And like Mike said, they've either not used the product, or it sounds like you're kind of trying to do a one-for-one or something. It seems odd. Personally, I would seriously consider moving to simpler pricing. If you're having this much trouble with it, why not charge per user? You know, a flat per user rate, and maybe when they get over 10, there's a slight discount, and over 50, there's a little slight more discount. But your tiers are 2-8 and unlimited is funky, and this is a very specific reason why it should be broken up there. But unlimited doesn't make any sense, because you're basically saying someone with 9 users should pay the same as someone with 500 users, and that doesn't make any sense, because someone with 9 users could be a small little agency, and someone with 500 is like an enterprise corporation, and they should be paying 30, 40 times more than that little enterprise because they're getting so much more value out of it. So I would never offer unlimited users with a SaaS app. So those are kind of my two thoughts of like, try to go per user pricing. It makes your page way simpler. And you're going to say, look, it's $9 a month per user, or it's $10 a month per user. And then if people say, can I get a volume discount? Then say, yeah, it starts at 50 users, you know, and you can deal with them. And most people won't be there, because frankly, people are emailing you and asking for discounts when they only have 3 users. If you're going to stick with this, you know, your original question, I would just say no. In general, no, that's not how the pricing works. The pricing is tiered, and that's how the tiers work. There is no discount just because you're not using all the seats.
Well, I think that wraps us up. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforthestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsforthestofus.com, where you also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.